Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is James Meredith, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
It's another listener's question special here on the Tennis Podcast. This one brought to you by James Meredith, another of our guest editors who backed us to the hilt in our Kickstarter campaign to keep the Tennis Podcast going for another year. And in so doing, he has given us the chance to produce weekly shows throughout 2019, daily editions at every Grand Slam. And we're going to do as many more as we can on top of those as well. Myself, David Law, alongside, not physically alongside, but joined by the wonders of modern technology, Catherine Whittaker. How are you doing?
Hello, David. Spiritually alongside you.
Yes, yes. And we're here, folks, to answer your questions, to answer James' questions. He's selected the best of those that you've put in on social media as well. And let's just get cracking, shall we, with James's first question, which is, will playing doubles help or hinder the chances of Stefanos Tsitsipas winning either a major or a Masters 1000 title this year? He's played that event, didn't he, with Wesley Kulhoff, the one that you found absolutely hilarious because of their post-match on-court speech in which Stefanos forgot to thank his partner. And they've now said that they're going to play seven Masters 1000 events this year together, I think. What do you think?
I think it's great, and I think more should do it. I mean, it's not to say it will necessarily work for everybody, but I think it will work for an awful lot more people than are currently doing it. Having said that, a lot of the next gen players do seem more inclined to play as spotter doubles than the generation before them, with the exception maybe of Nadal. Shapovalov's doing it, he's been playing with Rohan Bopanna, and that's something that his coach has been actively encouraging. I think it makes most sense at Masters 1000 level, particularly at the longer events like Indian Wells and Miami, where it's still best of three set tennis, but you have a lot of days off. Daniela Hantikova was saying she used to hate having days off at the bigger, longer events because she felt like she lost her rhythm. And that was why she played so much doubles. So I'd be surprised if we saw them play a lot of doubles at Grand Slam level. And I realise with that being best of five sets, that poses different challenges. But at Masters level, maybe the odd other tournament, I think by and large, it's a great idea. Because, winning is winning. That winning feeling, okay, it might be slightly reduced if you're getting it on the doubles court, but it's still winning, and it's still confidence. And those are things that you can't magic out of thin air. And I don't think it's any accident that we're seeing quite a lot of an increased level of variety from these younger guys, or certainly
that's a good point.
An increased willingness to introduce variety into their game. And I think that's great news, absolutely great news. Shapovalov he's determined to play with a lot of variety. Now, when he started doing that, his volleys weren't up to much, but he was determined to keep doing it and keep learning the sort of instincts of being at the net. And he's still not Roger Federer yet, but he's improving and has improved a lot. And doubles, playing a lot of doubles, will only help that more.
Should also be said that Roger Federer was not Roger Federer when he first started out in terms of his comfort at the net. I remember Federer, if you look back at old videos of when he played Wimbledon in 99, 2000, 2001, you watch the match against Sampras, he serves and volleys, first and second serve, every single time does Roger Federer back then, because that's what you do. Right, that was before they slowed the courts down. That's by before Leighton Hewitt and David Nalbandian had reached the final. It was only latterly that he started staying back because he started to realise that he could win that way. And obviously, if you go back 10 years before that, Jim Courier started staying at the back after second serves because Andre Agassi had won Wimbledon by staying back and returning incredibly well, and Courier also got to the final. But so I take your point totally. I think that Shapovalov's volleys will improve. I think Tsitsipas appears, and I'm loath to get too into the technicalities because I simply don't understand them well enough because I'm not an ex-player, but Tsitsipas seems to have a comfort level at the net already and a sort of intent to get to the net. So these are all good factors. I think you're right. I think doubles will definitely improve those. I think they are, and that's a great point about the responsibility for the variety that we're now seeing or contributing towards it. My concern over this is that there are a few players who've played singles and doubles in recent years. You mentioned Daniela as one of them. I also think you could question whether it has cost them and whether it's worn them out, whether if you actually looked at the results side by side, now you don't have a comparison level to say, oh, well, that player stopped playing doubles and necessarily started playing better singles, although Caroline Garcia, I think, had her best singles results. She won the WTA finals when she wasn't playing doubles. You may remember she gave it up for a while. But I love the idea of it. I love the idea whenever I talk to Joe Drury or Martina Navratilova or John McEnroe or any of these players, they always talk about how doubles was the best practice they could have had and that they all think that everybody should do it. I don't know how sustainable it is if you want to be the very best singles player that you can be. I'm just not sure.
Well, just ask John McEnroe. I think it depends whether you adjust your practice accordingly. You know, Daniela does have regrets in terms of overtraining and the sustainability of the eventual sustainability of her career and injury management and stuff, but she doesn't pin any of it on the doubles. I think I'm hoping we'll be able to get a really in-depth interview with her because she has so much to say. It's all mesmerizing.
Oh, I can't wait.
But she, I've never heard her attribute any of it to the doubles. Perhaps adjusting her training levels around the doubles. You know, she talks a lot about how she thinks she overtrained during portions of her career to make up for a lack of self-belief. But I've not heard her once say, I wish I'd played less doubles.
That's very interesting.
I will put it to her directly when we get that interview. But I'd be very surprised if she put it down to doubles at all.
I'm sure she wouldn't put it down to doubles. I wouldn't be surprised at all if you're quite right about that. But I wonder whether she just doesn't know. Because you can't know, can you? You can't know how your alternative universe might have panned out if you had done it differently. But what I think you can say, and I think quite strongly about this, that doubles aids your mental health.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's an overlooked factor for many reasons. You know, partly that mental health isn't nearly talked about enough. I think that's changing slowly. But absolutely, it's a lonely, unforgiving sport. And adding some sort of team element, some shared responsibility for a lot of people, for a lot of players, must be an immense relief.
James's second question. Will Kyle Edmund have a better career than Tim Henman?
Ooh.
And he qualifies better as saying, I'm thinking namely of things such as consistent top 10 ranking, which I don't think Kyle Edmund's had yet, best results in the slams and total tournaments won. Kyle Edmund, who reached the Australian Open semi-finals last year, and I think he got to 13 in the world, I think is his highest. Henman got to number 4 in the world.
I think by the parameters that James himself has set there, I would say no. By slightly different parameters, possibly yes. I think Kyle Edmund might end up having a better one-off or a couple of standout results. You know, I think it's conceivable that he could reach a Grand Slam final.
Possibly. Do you not think he would have had a better career then if he reaches a Grand Slam final, which Henman reached?
I'm just going on the parameters that James has set, which is consistent top 10 ranking. I don't think that Kyle Edmund will have the consistent top 10 ranking that Tim Henman had.
He does say best results in the slams, though, as well.
He does, but does he mean single standard? You know, Henman was incredibly consistent. I don't see Kyle Edmund has this explosive game, which I think can and might well be mirrored in his results. Henman had a very different style of game, still extremely watchable in its own way. It depends whether you're talking about consistency.
You and I interviewed Tim Henman here on the Tennis Podcast coming up to 5 years ago now, end of 2014. And one of the questions I asked him was, Marin Cilic had just won the US Open, and yet he'd never got to another, I think he'd reached one other Grand Slam semi-final at the Australian Open to that point. He's obviously done a lot more since then. He's reached Wimbledon final, Australian Open final. But back then, I said to Tim, you had six Grand Slam semis, you were four in the world. Would you switch with Marin Cilic for what he's had, i.e. winning the US Open but not doing all those other things that you've done?
And I've forgotten what he said, David.
He said, in a heartbeat.
Yes, he did, yeah.
And I think that is where I would stand on this situation. I mean, I don't know about if Cilic had lost in the final. I wonder what Tim would have said to that. We didn't ask, so we don't know. But I think you're right. I think that Edmund could reach a Grand Slam final. I think he could do it on clay. I think it would be really interesting to see whether he could manage that 1 year, maybe when Rafael Nadal bows out and we're in that sort of gap, because he's got another 6 years, 7 years of this left at least, injury, health permitting. And he's got such a big game on clay. It could happen, his Courier-like game. Don't forget, Courier reached three of those finals and won two of them. So, yeah, I think overall Henman will end up having had the better career, because I'm not 100% sold on Edmund reaching that Grand Slam final. And as things stand, certainly Henman's got the better career. But I do feel that Edmund pretty much will maximise his ability, which I think is all you can ask in the end, isn't it?
Yes, but by saying that, we have sort of wormed out of answering the question.
Okay, go on, answer it then. I'll say no.
I think no. Yeah, I think no. And I don't want to do Kyle Edmund down, because I entirely agree. I don't think Kyle Edmund will finish his career with regrets. Just as I don't think Tim Henman finished his career with regrets. He knows that he maximised. But I think if I had to commit now, I'd say no, not quite.
If Edmund reaches that final, that Grand Slam final, would you consider that a better career than Tim Henman's?
I don't know. I want to go back and ask Tim the question about if Marin Cilic had lost in the final.
Okay, well, we'll find Tim at some point and ask. What about if Edmund wins the slam, is that an open and shut case for you as well?
Oh, open and shut if he wins the slam, without question, yeah.
Me too. Okay, fine. Right, we've got all our answers out there. We've just got to go and find Tim Henman now, right? We'll do that in a few weeks.
Kyle, of course, has a Davis Cup winner's medal.
Yeah, but he didn't contribute to it, did he?
No, but he got to stand on the stage.
I could have done that. Except I couldn't get in the team. Despite my brilliant performances of late against Solly Hall-Simon. Rained off today, Catherine. Thought you might like to know. So who, in your view, James asks, is the most underrated player on the men's tour and the women's tour? Who's the most underrated player?
Have you already got ones in mind? Because if you have, then go ahead and give me some thinking time.
Oh, who's the most underrated player? I mean, probably Kevin Anderson, I would say.
Oh, Kev.
Who who, I mean, look, the guy has reached, look at all these people that we keep banging on about over the years of the tennis podcast, like Grigor Dimitrov. And I mean, honestly, you know,
not on this pod, David.
Well, we have over the years, haven't we? And he's reached a couple of Grand Slam semi-finals. It's not like it's been a terrible career. It's been a good career, but it hasn't been the career we expected him to have. And likewise, the career Kevin Anderson has had is not the career I think we would have thought he would have had. Two Grand Slam singles finals, I think, is a significant achievement over and above what I would have ever expected and what I ever said to anybody that he would do.
Agreed. But do you think that means he might have been underrated back then, but now he's getting the rating he warrants, isn't he?
No, because I still think he is not in the conversation. When did we ever put him in the final when we do our predictions for a Grand Slam? I can't remember doing it.
No, but I always have him in like the semi-finals or quarter-finals.
Do you?
He's always in. I never pick him to lose early.
No, but we didn't pick him to reach either of those two finals, did we?
No.
You know, anywhere close.
No, okay.
I would say.
Yeah, no, okay, yeah.
Who was it the other week that I was saying about in the women's game that we never pick?
Pliskova.
I said it in commentary, didn't
Pliskova.
I?
Pliskova.
Yeah, Pliskova.
Yeah, I think there are similarities
She never
there.
Gets mentioned. She's another one. I'm not sure, actually. I don't think she is underrated because I think, actually, at times, she's underachieved. I think that there's still a lot more in her to come. So I don't feel the same about her. I think she should have... She's reached one Grand Slam singles final. With her game, she served more aces than anybody on the circuit year after year. I think she should have done more.
Agreed. So they are both underrated, but in different ways? No. She's an underachiever. He's an overachiever. No, that's not fair either. Yes?
I think so. Yeah, I think he is underrated, and I think that she is... Yeah, I don't think she's underrated. I mean, she doesn't get mentioned that much, but that's because she keeps letting herself down, I think, relative to what she's capable of.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
I would say on the women's side, I think slightly underrated, actually, is Angelique Kerber. If you consider she's won three Grand Slam singles titles, and I still don't think she is put at the forefront of our conversation. I don't think we would have picked her to win any of those slams. Whereas Simona Halep, who's won one, I've put her in the final a number of times.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with any of this. Sold.
Wow. What's going on?
Sold to the woman in a dressing gown.
Anybody else who's underrated?
It's 3:37 p.m.
we can think of? I'm trying to think if there's anybody else who's underrated in this list of top 20 women.
I'm going down the sets of both rankings. I mean,
those are definitely the two for me.
Yeah.
Maybe Kiki Bertens is a bit underrated because she's sixth in the world, and again, she's not talked about that much. You know, we talk about her affectionately, but we don't talk about her that often as a threat.
You could say Marin Cilic is underrated as well.
Yes, I think
no one's
right.
ever picked him to win the 2014 US Open or reach the Australian Open final last year or reach the Wimbledon final the year before. No one, I don't think. Or maybe the Wimbledon final people did pick. But yeah, I think.
No, I think you're right, though. And actually, the funny thing is when he was really touted, including by me, as the Wimbledon champion of 2018, he lost to Guido Pella.
That has got to go down as the worst loss in Marin Cilic's career by country mile.
That has to be the only time he's gone into a big tournament expected to produce, and that suggests that he couldn't handle it.
As do his, I mean, he is, I think he's, relative to his ranking, the worst front runner in the men's game at the moment. As soon as he gets behind in the score, I think, right, we're going to see Marin Cilic play Marin Cilic tennis. And then he gets ahead and the literal wobbles start happening.
Yeah. At Tennis Podcast, let us know what you think. The most underrated player on the men's and women's tours. And also, let us know what you think about Edmund or Henman. Who's going to have the better career? So, who will finish the year ranked higher out of Johanna Konta or Dan Evans?
There's an awful lot of predictions involved in James's questions.
I know. Go on, James. Oh, James. I love this.
I have to say, though, that is a corker of a question. Absolute corker.
To let you know, Konta right now is ranked 45 in the world. I think Dan Evans is ranked about 86, something like that. Let's just see if I can get that exactly. But yeah, 45 in the world for Konta. She's kind of leveled out the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think 45 in the world is about right for Konta. Maybe she can get a tiny bit higher than that and maintain it consistently, but I think she's reached an equilibrium.
She was top 10 for 2 years, though. What's happened?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't Jeannie really Bouchard, know Grand Slam finalist, you know, these things do happen.
Hmm. Dan Evans is, just to check, is 89 in the world.
Well, I think Dan Evans will make top 50 by the end of the year.
Before his drugs ban, he was 41 in the world as a career high.
I think he'll get back there. So we're talking, oh, goodness me, I think it's going to be nip and tuck between those
Dan
two.
Evans.
Yeah, I think I might be as well. I do think it'll be close. I think they'll both be in the 40s. How about that?
Yeah, but you've got to say one way or the other.
Well, I'm going Dan Evans.
Okay, me too. Yeah, I think Evans might even break 40, actually. I think he could be in the 30s by the end of the year. So there we are. We're going out on a limb here, James. Let us know what you think at Tennis Podcast.
Absolutely no Birmingham-based bias. Certainly in my answer.
No, me either. Right.
It turns out he doesn't even live in Solihull anymore, David. He lives in, like, Worcester
Cheltenham.
Or something. Cheltenham. He's a turncoat.
I know. It's disgraceful. So looking back over
Cheltenham.
The last...
What's in Cheltenham?
The races. You know, the horses and all that.
Yeah, not a lot else, though.
No wonder he likes it. Looking back over the last 20 years, have there been any junior number one ranked players on the men's or women's sides that you expected to achieve more than they did stroke have to date on the ATP and WTA tours? Oh my goodness, there's so many.
Last 20 years, unfortunately, there are so many.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's a, there's a, there is just a sort of...
There's a graveyard, isn't there? There's a junior number one graveyard.
I was trying to look for a nicer way of saying it, but yes, there is.
Where do you want to start?
Well, I don't know whether... I don't even know if... I don't think Laura Robson ever made it to world number one junior.
Timo de Backer, David.
Yeah.
Who was mentioned on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, wasn't he?
He was, yeah, in relation to John Isner and right, picking up the pieces after the 70-68 scoreline.
What Timo de Backer is famous for, beating
John Isner.
John
needed to live with a chiropractor for the next 2 months.
Ricardis Berankis.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Who is not my favourite because I once shared a car with him from Montreal Airport to a hotel in Montreal, shared tournament transportation. We were picked up together. We weren't travelling together. I don't want rumours to start, but, you know, we were going in the same direction at the same time. So they asked if we would share a car, and we both happily said yes, yes, yes. And the driver, while we were going happily along our way, I was in the back, Ricardis was in the front, and the driver said to Ricardis Berankis, "Oh, is she your girlfriend?" And he replied, "Oh, hell no." So, yeah, not my favourite. He can happily live in the graveyard.
Not literally, but, you know.
No, the junior number one graveyard.
Yes.
In the same year that Ricardis Berankis was year-end junior number one, Ursula Radvanska was.
Yeah, the sister of Agnieszka, who, and she won Wimbledon juniors that year, in fact, Radvanska. And yeah, I mean, she has had a career of sorts on the main tour, and I know she had terrible injuries as well. I mean, that's the other thing you have to bear in mind. But some players, their games just don't translate. I mean, look at the one in the next year. Now, I'm going to really struggle with this. Nopawan Lechiwakan, who I believe is somebody I believe that Matt wrote about in his blog about juniors during the Australian Open. And she was the player that Laura Robson beat in the Wimbledon junior final in 2008. And if you can, I mean, I still think 14-year-old Laura Robson and the player that ended up breaking through and beating Linara and Kim Clijsters at the US Open, not being relevant today at the top of the game or in the top 50 even, or the top 100, is just one of the great disappointments and sadnesses that I have watching and having followed tennis of the last 10 years. I mean, I really like Laura. I've got to know her a little bit by commentating with her. But all that aside, just the loss that the sport has had to endure of her talent not being realised, mostly because of that horrible wrist injury that she had, which just took her career out, really, just derailed her completely. But it's so sad, I think, to see players like that not coming through. But look at the other players on the other side, on the men's side in those years. Have you ever heard of Yang Sung-hwa or Daniel Berta? Or one.
No, Daniel Berta from Sweden. They must have been so excited, Sweden, because what a wilderness time they've had in tennis.
Juan Sebastian Gomez.
The halcyon days of the 80s.
Who's that? Who's Juan Sebastian Gomez? Yuri Vesely the
Philip
next year.
Philip Poliwo.
Yuri Vesely, who's known for being the first player to beat Novak Djokovic in 2016 in Monte Carlo, when we'd had about 4 months of the year by then. And he finally managed to beat Djokovic, but he struggled to really make strides in the very top echelons of the game. Zverev is there, 2013.
Irina Kromacheva. Oh my crikey. On the women's side, girls' side.
Yeah, I mean, and which
Cece Bellis in the same year as Andre Rublev. Yeah. 2014. I know she's had some results, but she's struggled a little bit to transfer, hasn't she?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be fascinating,
well,
really.
The 2017 year-end junior number ones were Axel Geller, who I'm desperate to come through because I think tennis really needs a champion called Axel. He, on the basis of the little flag I'm looking at, is from Argentina. And Whitney Asigui, who I've heard a fair bit about. In fact, I think she was a recipient of a wild card in Miami. So they're the two who we might be expecting, if they are going to break through, to start hearing about coming up. But the previous year was Misha Kecmanovic, who of course had a good breakthrough in Indian Wells on the men's side. So, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's just absolutely no guarantee whatsoever. If anything, it's sort of potentially the opposite. It's, you know, it has the potential to be a bit of a poison chalice.
Well, it certainly can add pressure, can't it? And I do think that quite a few of these, and I do feel that Laura Robson was one of them, it's a lot to take on, really, all this expectation. Interesting that none of those, apart from Zverev, none of the ones that we talk about today finished end of year number one that we've talked about in recent weeks, like Auger, Aliassime, or Shapovalov, or Dimonor?
No, I believe Shapovalov certainly was number one.
Yes,
finish year-end number one. I mean, I suppose there is the kind of the balance between, you know, the more success they have as a junior, the less junior tennis they play. So they start playing senior events, and therefore their junior ranking suffers a bit, but I don't know how much that was at play.
Well, yeah, and there are certain players, Serena and Venus, for an example, and Rafael Nadal, who didn't or barely had junior careers at all. They just went straight on to the tour, you know. And
but then on the other side, you've got, you know, Roger Federer. Was he a year-end? He certainly was a junior number one, wasn't he?
And he won both Wimbledon singles and doubles, same year in 98. Yeah, those. It's always interesting to follow the progress of these players, but there's absolutely no guarantees whatsoever that the number ones will become relevant, even at the upper echelons of the men's and women's games.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Social media questions that have come in, picked out by James Meredith. Phil Boomy Noyen, who has asked, the best male and female players that never won a slam of all time.
Ooh.
Marcelo Rios would be mine.
Marcelo Rios, yeah.
The guy was a genius. If you watch that, some players' games look a little bit old hat now when you watch them, and I realise it's not that long ago that Rios played, but it's, you know, you're going back 20 years when he was world number one. He dominated in 1998. He won Indian Wells and Miami same year. And beat Agassi in the final of Miami. And it was such a shock to the locals, that was. And he went on then to win Monte Carlo and Rome. I mean, this is the sort of stuff he was doing. And ran into Carlos Moya at the French Open, having already been in the Australian Open final against Petter Korda in 98. And he was such an enormous favourite going into that 98 French Open. And was never really the same again after that. But talent-wise, left-handed, incredible ability, angles, he could do it all. He had everything. And he wasn't tall, he was just such a natural player. But an awful attitude. He had an awful attitude. And he was a nightmare to deal with.
I'd love to know. I mean, I don't think we're ever going to get a deep and meaningful sit-down with Marcelo Rios, but I'd love to know, really, honestly, whether he has regrets.
Well, I got to know him quite a bit on the Champions Tour in latter years, which is quite interesting because I had some serious run-ins with Rios during my ATP days in the late 90s when he was world number one. Everybody wanted to talk to him because he was world number one and because he was sort of supposed to talk to people being the world number one, and he had absolutely no interest in talking to anybody. Part of that was because he was hated in the locker room by many. I mean, I think some of the, well, I think the South American players and the Spanish players, some of them liked him, but he did not like any of the English-speaking natives, the Australians, Americans, Brits, didn't get on with any of us. Tim Hemman got on right with him, which was quite funny. But I recall Sports Illustrated running this story called "The Most Hated Man in Tennis" on the front page with a picture of Marcelo Rios, and that was even made things even worse in terms of the shutters going up. And then when I met him later on, about 8 years later, when he'd retired and joined the Champions Tour, I remember having a conversation in the locker room with a few players, and they were saying who was the toughest player to deal with, and Rios was in the room, and I said him, and he was really upset about it. He was, what do you mean, me?
Really?
I said, well, yeah, you. You were an absolute nightmare. I mean, you still are. But, you were worse then. And it was as though he didn't realise. But as a talent, just off the scale in terms of how good he was. And to think that he didn't win a Grand Slam is another terrible waste of ability, really. But I also think it shows how difficult it is to win a Slam, because it's different. It's best of five sets. And Kyrgios is kind of similar in that way. He's doing a lot less with his career generally than Rios did, but it's different to try to just handle all those situations.
Yeah. The other names that always get thrown out there are David Nalbandian,
yeah,
aren't they? Miroslav Machir as well. I might have to defer to you for memories, but he feels like he is a forgotten man,
yes,
of tennis, yeah. Miroslav
Machir.
He did
some coaching as well. A beautiful player to watch in terms of his movements. They called him the Big Cat, and he just used to float around the court. Didn't have enormous power, but just great accuracy. But again, at the very highest level, at the Slams, just... I mean, look, the quality he was up against, Edberg and Becker and Lendl, it was tough. But it was surprising back then that he didn't reach a Grand Slam final. I think
Philippoussis?
Philippoussis would be right up there, yeah, for me, given what he was capable of, power he had. Yeah. I mean, his power was otherworldly back then.
And the only one on the women's side that's really springing to mind is perhaps Elena Dementieva. I know she had issues on the serve, but retired very young.
There were other former world number ones, weren't there? There were players like Dinara Safina, Yelena Yankovic, players that got to finals but didn't win. We've now since had Halep and Wozniacki winning, of course, so that's ensured that they're not on that list. But yeah, I would go with Rios. I think Philippoussis and Kyrgios are others.
I mean, the
Kyrgios
stats
might, though,
bear out there, don't they? He's the only world number one never to win a slam on the men's side.
And now Nalbandian is a very good one too, because he had a number of wins against Federer, for instance, which, you know, you don't do that without knowing what you're doing on the court. And he did that on hard courts as well. Dan Connolly says, do you think that Serena will only be able to win her next slam when she addresses what happened at the 2018 US Open properly and accepts some blame for it publicly? Dan is one of our predictions backers as well on Kickstarter.
Hello, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Dan. Dan. That's Partridge joke. They always fall on deaf ears.
Good question.
To brush up on your Partridge, David.
Okay, I'll work on it. What was I supposed to say?
It's a great question. I would love for the answer to be yes. I would love for that to be what's holding her back, and for the trajectory to be that Serena comes to terms with her culpability for... she's not the only person to blame for what transpired, the various aspects of it, but comes to terms with her portion of the culpability. You know, apologises for it. As I've always said, I'm totally fine with her saying, look, I did something bad. I'm really sorry. I'd be quite happy to move on from that. I don't need Serena Williams to be a perfect human being. But I don't think that's the case. I don't know Serena at all. And I think there's a lot about her which is pretty unknowable to us. And we are really feeling our way in the dark, sort of guessing at how her mind works. But I don't think, sadly, it's troubling her. And I don't think it is what's holding her back from winning her post-comeback slam. What do you think?
I completely concur. I don't think it bothers her. That I think she thinks she's in the right, and pretty much end of story. And is it holding her back? No, not at all. I think she is one of the greatest champions sport has ever known. And I think that she is able to block out, certainly post an event like that, everything. She rolled her ankle against Karolina Pliskova in that Australian Open when she was really winning comfortably. And she was refusing to blame that, but that's why she ended up tailspinning the way she did, in my opinion. And I think that if she can get herself right physically, I don't think anything will stop her getting those extra couple of slams she wants to break the record. So no, I don't think that has any issues at all. And I agree with you. I think it's a shame that she hasn't seen fit to address it and accept some culpability in it. But that's my view. That's her view. She's entitled to it. That's all there is to it, really, isn't it? And finally, Arvind, chosen by James Meredith, our guest editor.
Is it Palmer? Is it Arvind?
Could
Palmer?
Be. No, it says at BH. Snermath says, "Should the tennis
no, so unless it's Arvind Palmer in disguise,
could be. Should the Tennis Hall of Fame start accepting nominations for great coaches, given the current emphasis on it?"
Look, I don't quite get the Tennis Hall of Fame, and I think that's okay. First and foremost, a Hall of Fame is a really American concept. So it doesn't surprise me that I don't quite get it in the way that an American might. I'm fine with it existing. I can see what it means to certain people when they're inducted. You know, it was Andy Roddick and Kim Clijsters that were inducted not long ago, wasn't it? And both of their speeches were wonderful and really emotional. And I think that's great. I don't quite understand why, you know, you've got two Grand Slam titles or whatever, you're a former world number one, just that makes you, you know, spiritually a whatever a Hall of Famer means. Why does there have to be a sort of unscientific nomination and election process for you to be considered officially a Hall of Famer? And why is there not more set parameters? Why is it a nomination and election process? You know, surely if you've achieved certain things, you are whatever it means to be a Hall of Famer. That's what I don't quite understand about it, and therefore does personality start to come into it? You know, I don't really know the answers to any of those things, but then I don't think it's aimed at me, because I'm a cynical British person, and I think the Hall of Fame is aimed at, you know, optimistic Americans that like having ceremonies for stuff, and good luck to them. It there are lots of people in tennis that it means a lot to, and it is significant, and I wouldn't for a moment want to take that away from them. It's not doing any harm to anyone that it exists. And Todd Martin's the president of it, isn't he? And he comes and gives a speech every year at the International Tennis Writers Drinks event that they have on the eve of the US Open. He always speaks really well about it, and I always feel bad that I'm sort of stood there thinking, I don't quite get this, especially as they give you a free International Tennis Hall of Fame t-shirt on your way out, which I wear proudly. but yeah, yeah, sure, let coaches in. It's sort of a little bit neither here nor there to me.
I'm generally of a similar mentality, same background in terms of being British and not really understanding them, because we don't really have them culturally here as much or if at all as they do in America, in which they have in all sports, it appears. I have to say I'm warming to it more than I was, and I think part of that is because of the efforts that are made to engage with us, the media, at that International Tennis Writers do that you mentioned, with Todd Martin coming and speaking so passionately about it. Talking to Andy Roddick when he was in that conversation as well, it meant so much to him, and the concept of it really meant a lot to him. And I use him, I suppose, as a bit of a barometer for Americans in a way, just because I like and respect him, and he is able to slightly translate meaning for me a little on certain things that are somewhat alien to me. I'd like to go to the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport at some point.
When Federer plays next year.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe, yeah. I'm hoping to go in the summer, actually. Whether I get there or not, I don't know. But
apparently, by all accounts, it is wonderful. And if I were ever in that part of the world, I would make an effort to go as well. I'm not so cynical about it that I would.
No, we would walk around it just open-mouthed, I'm sure. But look, I take all your points on board, and I don't really get it either. But there's nothing that much to get. It's a celebration of people, isn't it? And achievement and important figures in a game. So it's a positive generally in that regard. But yeah, why not have coaches in it as well? I think the only problem with coaching these days is that it's just become so transitory. In recent years, there's so much change. The really great coaches that I love watching are the ones that are synonymous with a player, really, I suppose. I think
it would have to be a separate hall. The International Coaching Hall of Fame. You couldn't have them in the same hall.
Well, at the moment, they have a broadcaster's one or a contributor's one, of which broadcasters such as Steve Flink and Mary Carrillo, I think, was up for it last
year. Hang on, Mary Carrillo hasn't won it.
I think she has, actually.
I think she is in it, actually.
I'm going to just do a quick Google search. John Barrett's in it. John Barrett, who we love so much, the British former player and commentator. I thought Mary Carrillo was in it, but actually I've just
Googled
her name.
If she's not in it, then...
She's not coming up.
I'm not
on board.
What's the point?
Yes, as you can tell, we're a tennis podcast biased here.
No, we're not. She's objectively brilliant.
Well, she is. I agree. The best. So, right. Well, that's about it for another edition.
Hang on, what is your Google thrown up?
The tennis podcast. It says here, Mary Carrillo inducted into Sports Broadcasting Hall of Fame in December of 2018. So it
yes,
looks like
we
she's
know that happened
in.
Last year.
That's a different one then.
One of three women.
Yes.
In about. Out of about 80 or something.
Yeah, that's not the same thing, is it?
It's not the same thing, it's separate.
She got the Jean Scott Award from the International Tennis Hall of Fame.
Ah, yes. They give out one of those annually, don't they?
Yeah. Another very, very well-received and well-deserved award. So, yeah, just give awards to Mary Carrillo, folks, all right? Then we're quite happy. And I think on that note, Catherine, we can end another edition of the Tennis Podcast, which has been brought to you in association with The Tennograph, executive produced by tennisballs.com, with our mascot, Rio with a Y. We're going to be back with more tennis podcasts all the way through the clay court season, the grass court season. We'll be daily at the French Open, at Roland Garros, and during Wimbledon and Queens, the US Open. We can only do it because we are backed by our Kickstarter backers, such as James Meredith, who has guest edited this particular edition of the show. And we will be back with more of these very soon. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about...
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.